This is WMUK's West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans. Coming up, writer Robert Weir joins us to discuss his latest article for Kalamazoo's Encore magazine. He chronicled a pilgrimage to 13 key sites in the civil rights movement. But first, the infant mortality rate for black children in Kalamazoo County has been a long-term problem. The rate for minority children is among the highest in the state. The disparity in infant mortality for black and white babies is especially stark. A new initiative called Cradle Kalamazoo will include a community hotline in an attempt to connect families to health services in the Kalamazoo area. Grace Labwama is the CEO of YWCA Kalamazoo. Thanks for being here.
Well, thank you for having me.
So why was it decided that this was the approach to, again, try to chip away at the black infant mortality rate in Kalamazoo County?
You know, when we talk about infant mortality from a public health perspective, it's such a complex issue. But what we are trying to do here at Cradle Kalamazoo is really create systems, create strategies that are long-term. In 30 years, we don't want to be talking about infant mortality in Kalamazoo. So what we have done in the last 3 years, I was here 3 years ago talking about bringing different community agencies together, bringing residents together, and really designing a strategy that will address the black infant mortality rates in Kalamazoo, especially among its black population. So we are doing different phases of the strategy, and I'm excited to be here today to talk about one of our phases for that strategy, whereby we want to connect pregnant women to resources in Kalamazoo.
So explain what happens here if somebody calls this hotline. Who will they talk to and what happens then?
So we have a hotline right now, which is 888 kids. And this is an opportunity for us to connect resources to pregnant women. So if you know anybody who is pregnant in Kalamazoo, if you know anybody that has a child, you know, this is an opportunity for people not to think through what the process is. You know, let us do the work. You refer that person. There'll be a live person speaking to that individual. We have partnered together with 30 agencies in this community and with the leadership of United Way, leadership of Griffin Place, WMED to kind of read the data, and then the YWCA in Kalamazoo, families will have an opportunity to be linked to all services within our community.
So when someone makes this phone call, who's at the other end answering the phone?
So there will be an individual with Griffin Place. There will be staffed with Griffin Place, and somebody will answer the phone and give them, connect them to the resources. And if you need a home visitation, that individual will connect you to somebody within the home visitation program, whether it's a nurse or a social worker or an outreach worker. That will be your connection to services.
Are there a lot of different agencies here where somebody might end up talking to someone or being directed to because of, you know, their circumstances, you know, whatever the pregnancy may include, you know, complications, that sort of thing. Are you trying to find out here where this person might need to go?
That is correct. So it's kind of a triage process. And like I said, this is a group of 30 agencies that are coming together. You know, I'm proud to say that two of our major hospitals are part of those partners. You know, the Family Health Center is part of those partners. You know, nonprofit organizations that have home visitation programs are part of that partnership. So what is key here is when you call in into this hotline, there will be a person that will walk you through the process and then make sure that they link you to the services. And what is so exciting is even after that linkage, after a couple of weeks, somebody else will call you back and say, did we connect you to the right resources? Did you hear back from them? Did you receive what you needed? Is there anything else that you want us to do? I'm so excited about the system that has been created to really provide support and networks to families. What is very interesting is a lot of what families struggle with is finding and navigating resources in this community. You know, we have plenty. Kalamazoo is a community rich of resources. And if we can help families navigate, that is what this number is going to do.
What are some of the questions you think someone might call and have, you know, that they might call this hotline and you know, might pose to an operator there that then they're going to turn and try to find a specialist to help them? What sort of things do you think might be on the mind of a family with, you know, a pregnancy which is in progress?
Mm-hmm. So if any individual calls, if a person calls and they're pregnant, the first thing they're going to ask you, you know, are you pregnant? And then they'll ask you, you know, what's your background? What are your basic needs right now? What are the resources? And then we have criteria of different programs within the system. So based on the answers that you give, the specialist is trained to work with you on what best resource is best for you. If you need a physician to be connected to a physician, that specialist will help do that. If you need a home visitation, if it's something about housing, they will make sure they are specialized to connect you to those resources.
Nutrition?
Nutrition as well. Yes, nutrition, you know, a lot of things. And I remember when I was pregnant a long time ago, sometimes you just need somebody to be there to let you know how you can support your child. And those are what the specialists will be doing with these families.
This past summer, you were speaking to the Kalamazoo County Commission about some of the possible ideas for trying to address Black infant mortality in Kalamazoo County. You mentioned cultural differences between service providers and the people that they are serving pregnant women. Are you addressing some of that in this hotline number that people will call?
Yes. And when you look at the infant mortality data in Kalamazoo, two things that the data has pointed out, you know, being Black and being poor as one of the key indicators. So as we are addressing the racial disparity that exists in this community, especially when we are talking about Black babies dying at four times higher than white babies, we have to talk about culture. You know, we have to talk about diversity. So one of our target populations will be looking at all Black women in this community, all women that are living below income level, and then integrating that with the providers, working with the providers to understand the culture differences that we face and some of the racial differences that we have in this community and how that can impact the health of individuals. So, you know, Credo Kalamazoo is working hard to work with providers, provide training, work with systems so that we incorporate the racial justice component in the work.
You mentioned race and poverty, and I'm sure that there are some people that are hearing those two things just blended together and say, well, the poverty rate's higher for African Americans. Mm-hmm. That explains the difference in infant mortality. But as I've had it explained to me over the years, if you look at a African American woman who is middle class, she is still more likely to lose a child either in childbirth or shortly thereafter than a white woman who we would consider in poverty.
That is correct. That is why for us, the data is pointing to race and poverty. You know, the data is showing, you know, wealthy Black women living in this community have poorer birth outcomes than poor white women. So that's why when we are really developing strategies, understanding that yes, income is a protector, but there's still racial disparities despite of socioeconomic status. So that's why really the culture competency and understanding, you know, the history, the stress of being Black in United States or in this community, what it means, and therefore designing strategies that can support that population.
But, you know, I one of the things I have found interesting about this, and admittedly frustrating, is that Kalamazoo County continues to have this rate, which is higher than just about anywhere else, at least in Michigan, and higher than a lot of places other in the country. And I guess the question is, why is this problem so persistent in Kalamazoo and not other areas where there are also, you know, diverse communities with, you know, African Americans and whites and Hispanics, et cetera?
You know what? And that could be complicated to explain, but health disparities exist in almost every community in the United States right now. And what the challenge for Kalamazoo is our infant mortality, which is a key indicator of how well we are taking care of our most vulnerable, is a message of what is happening in our community. But what is exciting is we are doing something about it right now. And the goal for Credo Kalamazoo is by 2020, we will not be talking about infant mortality. We'll be one of those communities that has done something, acknowledged that we had a problem, and are building strategies to do something about it. That's why this number, 888 kids, is a number that should be on everybody's mind. We want to make sure that families feel supported in this community and get the resources that they need.
Grace Labama is the CEO of YWCA Kalamazoo. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you for having me.
Links with more information about Cradle Kalamazoo and a longer version of this interview can be found at WMUK.org. This is WMUK's West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans. Writer Robert Weir wanted to look more deeply into the civil rights movement and the country's ongoing struggle for racial equality. He decided to travel along with the Living Legacy Pilgrimage, which is hosted by the Living Legacy Project, and wrote about that journey for the February issue of Encore magazine. Robert Weir, thank you for being with us.
Gordon, it's a pleasure to be here with you this morning. Thank you for the invitation to be here.
First of all, explain to our listeners what is the Living Legacy Pilgrimage.
The Living Legacy Pilgrimage is a historical bus tour through 13 locations in the southern states of Memphis, Tennessee, then several locations in Mississippi and Alabama that were key sites in the civil rights movement back in the 1950s and the 1960s. And yet it was not just a historical tour that we went on, because much of the conversation also dealt with the corollaries or the parallels that are happening in the world today in regard to human rights issues. And so history was discussed, but also the application of history to how we can make the world a better place today for all people, regardless of the color of skin.
What made you decide that at this particular point you wanted to be part of this, you wanted to go on this pilgrimage?
That's a great question, Gordon. And it starts with the fact that I was born in 1948. And so I was alive during the civil rights movement, and yet a little too young to be a participant in it. And quite honestly, having grown up in a Michigan rural village that was all white, I didn't know much about the civil rights movement, not until Martin Luther King was assassinated. And so in my adult years, I've begun to write and speak about social issues, peace, justice, the care of Earth, which is a title of one of the books that I've written. And I realized that I'm learning about Martin Luther King and Fred Shuttlesworth and others who were involved in the civil rights movement, but very secondhand. And when I learned about the Living Legacy Pilgrimage, I said, I want to go. I want to go, and at least for 8 days, immerse myself into what happened then. And my gosh, it was an eye-opening experience. I just learned so much about the brutality, the segregation, the discrimination, the lynchings, the beatings, the atrocities that some American citizens inflicted upon other American citizens.
You say that fittingly, this journey begins in Memphis, Tennessee. Why is that appropriate?
Because, let's say, the key figure in the civil rights movement is certainly Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. In Memphis, Tennessee, at the Lorraine Hotel, is where he was assassinated. And on the first day of the pilgrimage, which was a Sunday morning, we went to a church and participated in the service led by an African-American minister in front of an African-American congregation who said to us, it's such a pleasure to see so many white folks here. And this is what church should look like, where people are there not because of the color of their skin, but because they're people who want to participate in the service. From there, and so that was like the warm-up, but from there, we then went to the National Civil Rights Museum, which, well, it is in the Lorraine Hotel where Dr. King was assassinated, and it is a renovation of that hotel or motel. The National Civil Rights Museum has just got such a comprehensive history about slavery, segregation, the fact that, you know, the education being separate but equal really didn't work out, and slavery today, issues about slavery today. But also, interestingly enough, the Lorraine Hotel or the National Civil Rights Museum includes the boarding house across the road from where James Earl Ray shot Martin Luther King. And his room in the bathroom from which he shot King is there. And you can stand at a window almost right next to
James Earl Ray
fired the bullet, the fatal shot, and you can see the trajectory. You can see the balcony. And so it's eerie to stand where an assassin stood.
In Mississippi, you say that you end up visiting the scenes of violence and injustice, even more so than in Memphis. And here's a line from your story that stands out to me. This is talking about Emmett Till. Today, 40 fresh bullet holes puncture the historical marker that stands where Emmett Till's body was found. This 40 fresh bullet holes, meaning sometime in the fairly recent past, someone felt the need or whatever to pull out a gun and shoot at a historical marker, which notes the brutal murder of this boy in Mississippi.
Gordon, the story of Emmett Till is really an amazing story, and it's continuing today. In 1955, August 24th, 1955, Emmett Till was a 14-year-old black youth. He was raised in Chicago, and so he had some sort of pizzazz about him. But he went to visit his great uncle in Mississippi and made the mistake, apparently, of flirting with a woman named Carolyn Bryant, who was a 21-year-old beauty queen. She was married, and she and her husband owned this little store in Money, Mississippi. And because of the protocol at that time, and I have to give a little sidebar here, that I also spoke with a man, a civil rights activist at the time, who said that you have to realize that as a black man, as a black boy, if I encountered a white person on a sidewalk, it was my responsibility to step in the street so this person could walk by. Also, you never, ever looked at a white woman in the face because that was considered eyeball rape and the punishment was death. Okay, so supposedly, Emmett Till committed by flirting did something even more than just looking at Carolyn Bryant in the face. And Carolyn Bryant told her husband, and her husband and his half-brother then went and abducted Emmett Till from the great uncle's home in the middle of the night at gunpoint. And 3 days later, Emmett Till's body was found in the Tallahatchie River. And the brutality that had been inflicted upon that young man was just significant. He had broken bones, teeth were knocked out, his nose had been chopped at with a hatchet, and his head had been cleaved laterally down to the ears. And then he'd also been shot at point blank range behind the right ear so that the bullet exited through the left eye. He was immediately put into a casket, and the casket was totally sealed up. His mother, Mamie Till Bradley, was an absolutely courageous woman. She said, "I want to see my son. I want that body shipped back up here to Chicago." And then she had the courage, audacity you might say, to say, "I'm going to show the world what happened to my son." And there was an open casket funeral. And something like 10,000 people came there. Some of them fainted. And it was Al Sharpton who said that Mamie Till Bradley was able to bring home what 1,000 speeches couldn't, because of people seeing Emmett Till's face. So the story continues today in that it was just recently announced about a week ago that Carolyn Bryant has told a biographer that she made up the story that Emmett Till had flirted with her.
So this flirting, which of course is not something that should have led to the horrible acts committed on Emmett Till anyway, never even happened, apparently.
Apparently not. One of Carolyn Bryant's relatives reportedly said in the news recently that Carolyn really just wanted not to be alone with her kids in the store. She wanted her husband to be there in the store with her. And maybe if she had told, by telling her husband what Emmett Till had done, he would quit his truck driver job and be there in the store with her. So she had an ulterior motive that ended up in this brutal killing of Emmett Till.
In Alabama, you visit another scene of a horrific act of violence, the bombing of the 16th Street Baptist Church. The fact that 4 girls died is disturbing. Is it somewhat more disturbing that it took so many years after that happened for those who had been responsible for it to be brought to justice.
Gordon, your question addresses the mentality of segregation and white supremacy that was so prevalent there at that time. Because, yes, it was on September 15, 1963, when the 16th Street Baptist Church in Birmingham was blasted. Four young girls were killed in that blast. One was 11. The other three were 14 years of age. And within a short period of time, like within a month, a man had been charged and brought to trial. His name was Bob Chambliss, and he was a Ku Klux Klansman. His nickname was Dynamite Bob because he had supposedly and bragged about blowing up the homes and churches of African Americans there in the greater Birmingham area. And he was brought to trial on charges of murder. But the only charges that really stuck is that he was charged a fine of $100 and 6 months in jail for possessing 122 sticks of dynamite illegally. Then in 1977, this would be 14 years later, he was brought to trial again. And this time he was convicted on four counts of murder for killing those girls. And what's interesting at that time, at the time of the first trial, the FBI was involved. But the FBI records, as we look back at them from a later period of time, indicate that FBI Director J. Edgar Hoover had personally been involved in the case and told his agents to withhold information that would have convicted Chambliss at his first trial. That information was released by the FBI for his second trial, and it led to his conviction, as well as the conviction of two of his accomplices a short time later.
While in Alabama, you also retraced the steps of the march from Selma to Montgomery. Just give us an idea of what that experience is like.
That march began in Selma, Alabama, on what's known as Bloody Sunday, when about 600 people crossed the Edmund Pettus Bridge, which leads from Selma, Alabama itself, across the Alabama River into a county area where there's a different jurisdiction. And coming across that bridge, these people were met by Alabama state troopers and county deputies, many of them who had been deputized like the day before and were known to be Ku Klux Klansmen, and significantly beat and tear gassed these people. And this made national news. Then 2 days later, Dr. Martin Luther King was there. He led some more people across the bridge, knowing that they also were likely not to go any farther. No disturbance happened at that time. They knelt in prayer in front of the state troopers and the county deputies and then turned around. This became known as Turnaround Tuesday. Then it was about 2 weeks later, Dr. King was able to obtain a ruling by a federal judge that would allow for the freedom marchers to walk from Selma, Alabama to Montgomery, Alabama, to the Capitol. And again, crossing the Edmund Pettus Bridge. So to get to your question about what it was like, we on this Living Legacy pilgrimage also walked across the Edmund Pettus Bridge. We parked our tour bus on the Selma city side and then crossed in the same direction that the marchers did. The Edmund Pettus Bridge, well, first of all, is named after a man who was a Ku Klux Klansman of high rank and a Alabama senator who opposed the giving blacks rights after the end of the Civil War. He was a senator during the Reconstruction period. And the bridge is still named after him.
Also a Confederate general, if
I'm not
mistaken.
He was a general in the Confederate Army. Yes, thank you. So for us, we started walking from the city side. And the bridge is of a kind of high humpback design. There were 35 people on the pilgrimage, and we walked in silence, side by side, two by two, on the sidewalk part of the bridge. And I was toward the back of the group. so that I could only see the bridge hump in front of me. I could see the backs of people in front of me, the other pilgrims I was with, but I couldn't see what's on the other side. And in this walking, meditative, contemplative kind of state, I began to imagine what it would be like to have been there back in the 1960s. And knowing that we were going to have some kind of encounter, whether it would be violent or not, you know, what's going to happen? It really was a historical moment, a living historical moment, to go back and try to experience what it might have been like for the people who were walking then from Selma to Montgomery.
So in Encore, you have a little sidebar story where you talk to some people from Kalamazoo and share their experiences of racism, of being harassed, of trying to forge their own way to achieve some sort of racial equality. How do you think those stories fit in with this civil rights pilgrimage?
The people here in Kalamazoo with whom I spoke are all African-American men and women of a senior age. Some of them are retired. Moses Walker, Dr. Martha Warfield, Dr. Ben Wilson, Dr. Von Washington, and Jacob Johnson, who's a younger man, but he spoke on behalf of his father and grandfather, and Dr. Lewis Walker also. All of these people had some story of how they had been unjustly treated because of the color of their skin. And Moses Walker, for example, who was born in Kalamazoo, said that his mother, who was born in Mississippi, just drummed into him and his brothers, "None of my sons will ever step foot in Mississippi," because she had seen black young men and some women lynched for no reason other than the color of their skin, or maybe because they did something that a white supremacist group thought was inappropriate for good black behavior. Martha Warfield told an interesting story. She was raised in Dowagiac and was a member of the high school band that was allowed and invited to play at the Orange Bowl in 1955. And when they got there, they found that their accommodations were segregated. And there were five black musicians in the Dowagiac High School band. And Martha's parents were among the chaperones. And they said, "Well, okay, if there's no place for our kids to stay here, we'll just go back to Michigan. To heck with the Orange Bowl parade and the halftime show." But the band director said, "Wait a minute. These are all key players, including the drummers. He's the lead drummer. You know, if we're going to be able to perform at all, we need them to be here." And so the black musicians, well, the NAACP got involved there in the Miami area and found accommodations for the black bandsmen at a different kind of a ritzy hotel in Miami Beach, which was not segregated. And it turns out the Count Basie band was playing there. And so the youngsters got an invitation to come and perform for a set with the Count Basie band, a great privilege, which, you know, this is sort of like the good side of the story. But then, as Martha said, the other side of the story is that when we were all together with the white members of the high school band, those white members very dutifully pointed out, "Well, there's the colored bathrooms, there's the colored drinking fountains," even though back in Dowagiac, they all shared the same facilities. It's like the white mentality just said, "We are in a segregated state and we need to follow the protocol down here." So yeah, these different stories of injustices, these African-American elders with whom I spoke, I think added a nice flavor, a local flavor to the article.
Robert Weir, thank you very much for your time.
You're welcome.
Links to Robert Weir's articles for Encore, Remembering the Struggle, and Kalamazoo's own stories of past struggles, plus a longer version of this interview, can be found at WMUK.org. This is WMUK's West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans.